from Valentine's Day flowers to coupons for mani-pedis. The average sales rep's most basic tool was Dine and Dash, a play on the juvenile delinquent prank of leaving a restaurant without paying the bill. For a chance to pitch their wonder drug, reps had long offered free dinners at fancy restaurants. But soon, to-go options abounded, too, for busy doctors' convenience. Reps began coming by before holidays to drop off a turkey or a beef tenderloin that a doctor could take home to the family, even a Christmas tree. Driving home from the office, doctors were also invited to stop by the nearest gas station to get their tanks topped off while listening to a drug rep's pitch at the pump, a variation the reps nicknamed Gas and Go. In the spring, the takeout menu featured flowers and shrubs in a version some dubbed, you guessed it, Shrubbery and Dash. There seemed to be no end to the perks or to the cloying wordplay. At a bookstore event titled Look for a Book, an invitation issued by Smith Klein Beecham asked doctors to come pick out the latest book about your favorite hobby or travel destination. Purdue reps were heavily incentivized, buoyed by $20,000 cash prizes and luxury vacations for top performers in a corporate culture that employed terminology from the Middle Ages to pump up its foot soldiers. Internal documents referred to reps as royal crusaders and knights, and supervisors went by such nicknames as the Wizard of OxyContin, the Supreme Sovereign of Pain Management, and the Empress of Analgesia. Purdue's head of pain care sales signed his memo simply, King. Physicians willing to submit to reps' pitches were routinely given not just branded pens and post-it notes, but also swing music recordings labeled Swing in the Right Direction, and freebie pedometers with the message that OxyContin was a step in the right direction. A chain-smoking doctor in Bland, Virginia was so blatantly in favor of graft that she posted a sign-up sheet in her office soliciting reps to sponsor her daughter's upcoming birthday party at Carowinds, an amusement park, and one, not a Purdue rep, did. She even accepted cartons of cigarettes emblazoned with a sticker for Celexa, the antidepressant manufactured by Forest Laboratories, another gift from another clever rep. Steve Huff was in medical residency training in the mid-1990s when he sampled his first taste of pharmaceutical swag, and not just by way of stickers, golf balls, and pens adorned with drug company names. We were impressionable young doctors, fresh meat with a lifetime of prescribing ahead, and they flocked to us, he told me. They took us golfing. It was standard to have a free lunch most days of the week because the drug companies were always buying. Then you'd have a short educational seminar going on about their drugs while you ate. By the time he progressed to a family practice, Huff decided the free meals were wrong and said so repeatedly, making a show of retrieving his cold leftovers from home from the office fridge, he told me. When he set about trying to coax the other doctors in his practice to ban the lunches, they demurred, saying the staff would be so disappointed if we took away their free meals, Huff said. The reps tended to be outgoing, on the youngish side of middle-aged, and very good-looking. They were bubbly, they'd flirt a little bit, and it really would make you feel special. And yet intertwined in all those feelings is the name of a drug, which the rep is repeating over and over while you're eating this delicious savory meal, and even if you say you're not swayed by such things, there is no doubt in my mind that you're more than likely to prescribe it, Huff added. Huff didn't fall for the rep's pitches. In fact, he stopped accepting pharmaceutical gifts altogether, even post-it notes and pens. At his first family medicine practice in Stuart, Virginia, Huff prescribed OxyContin a time or two, but most of the patients returned as miserable as ever and still complaining about pain, he said, along with new side effects that included sleepiness, confusion, constipation, and unsteadiness on their feet. A few of them would stay on a stable dose once it was titrated properly, but more often than not, it was causing problems, both for the patients and for Huff. He noted an uptick in depression and memory loss, too, among the long-term opioid users at the practice, as well as alarming news stories about drug seekers in the community breaking into those patients' homes or cars to steal their drugs. When he moved his practice to the Carroll County hamlet of Laurel Fork to fill a spot left by two departing doctors in 2003, Huff was deluged with young adult and middle-aged patients who'd been prescribed large amounts of OxyContin by his predecessors, concurrently with benzodiazepines such as Xanax, Clonopin, and Valium, nerve pills, as most in Appalachia called them. There was nothing in their charts to justify why they were getting so many prescriptions, Huff said, and he knew the added benzos put the patients at enormous risk of overdose. As one recovering addict in Lee County schooled me, around here, pairing an oxy with a nerve pill, we call that the Cadillac high. If you're going to write this book, honey, you better learn the lingo. Many of Huff's patients lived in nearby Galax, a factory town that had just witnessed the closing of two of its largest employers, Hanes Brands Clothing and Webb Furniture, and continued downsizing in the town's remaining plants. In the wake of the 1994 North American Free Trade Agreement and China's entry into the World Trade Organization in 2001, many of the sewing factories and furniture plants were gravitating to cheaper wage countries south of the border and in Asia. OxyContin wasn't just numbing pain and the depression that came along with it. The drug was now its own resource to be plundered. You could get a big bottle of 80 milligram tablets and sell them for a dollar a milligram, and you could pretty much live on that for a month, Huff said, until Huff slammed the brakes on the Laurel Fork narcotics train. People freaked out on me, he recalled. They were sick and in withdrawal, some of them not yet understanding they were addicted. Just about every day I was having to go in and face another 10 people and tell most of them, I'm discontinuing your narcotics. It was really strenuous. It drained me, he remembered. One period was so awful that he got in his car and drove to Mississippi to see his sister for a long weekend. Two patients had threatened his life that week. To one of the region's longtime health department directors, Dr. Sue Cantrell, a former pharmacist, the premiere of OxyContin could not have been timed worse. With the exception of mining, production jobs in the coal fields had never paid much. Cantrell remembered setting up a mobile clinic in the parking lot of the Buster Brown apparel factory in the early 1990s because the women who worked there did piecework. They were paid by the number of sewn pieces they produced, and they had zero sick leave. They couldn't leave work to have a pap smear or a breast exam, so we took the clinic to them, Cantrell recalls. Even though the pay wasn't great, those production jobs gave two things to our communities. One, families on the margin didn't always have to be on the brink of not having food on the table or money for utilities. And the second, more important thing, was the behavior it modeled for families where people got up in the morning and went to work. A lot of people never finished high school, just like the people who went into the mines, but they used to have a source of income before it dried up to nothing, and there have been no jobs to replace those, she said. Jobs in coal mining, once the number one industry in central Appalachia, were cut in half between 1983 and 2012, owing to pollution regulations and competition from natural gas and cheaper, low-sulfur coal out west. Automation in mining and the closings of factories that burn coal for power also contributed to the region's decline. The closings were just sinking in when Cantrell took her first call about OxyContin from a doctor in tiny St. Charles, the next to poorest town, population 159 and waning, in the poorest county in the state. Tall and skinny, Dr. Art Van Zee stood out. He was a Vanderbilt-educated minister's son from Nevada who spoke softly with no discernible accent. He'd come to the region in 1976 at the age of 29 because he wanted to work in a medically underserved community. The town's new federally qualified community center with its sliding fee scale was as close to the socialized medicine model he admired as he could find. That's where he met his wife, Suella Kobach, a firecracker lawyer and activist. A coal miner's daughter raised in a Kentucky coal camp just over the mountain in Poor Bottom Hollow. Introduced by mutual friends, the two had their first real date at an NAACP rally in Bristol, Virginia, called as a response to a planned KKK rally and ending with everyone holding hands and singing We Shall Overcome. After they married a few years later, the flower girl was a three-legged goat. Most locals began referring to the pair as Doc and that woman, as Suella tells it, because she refused to change her name. Van Zee seemed to have all the time in the world for his patients, never mind that he worked 16-hour days. Rising at 4 in the morning to type up his patient notes from the previous day's visits. A doctor who trained in Philadelphia recalled working with Van Zee during medical school and residency. We'd rotate in and out of these big medical centers, and when we get back to school, it would occur to us the best doctor in America is actually out in Lee County, Virginia, he told me. Locals often compared Van Zee with his salt and pepper beard and gangly frame to Abraham Lincoln, if Lincoln had worn a paperclip for a tie clip to work, if Lincoln had been spotted routinely jogging on the winding mountain roads. I had read about Van Zee in Barry Meyer's deeply startling but little-known 2003 book Painkiller, which chronicled the country doctor's early David versus Goliath battle to get OxyContin off the market until it could be reformulated to be abuse-resistant. I had not yet met Van Zee in early 2016 when I ran into one of his patients coming out of a town hall meeting on opioids sponsored by the Obama White House. She was a nurse, a recent retiree with a 30-year-old opioid-addicted son whose life, she swears, was saved by Art Van Zee. When his patients are admitted to the ER, he comes there and sees them no matter what time of day. When my daddy died, he came to our house at 2 a.m. to pronounce his death. Tales of Van Zee's dedication are as common in Virginia's coal fields as the rusted-out coal tipples that blanket the bluffs. There was the time he bent his lanky frame into the back of an ambulance to accompany a patient in cardiac arrest for the hour-long ride to the nearest hospital. The time he was so tired from all the house calls and beeper interruptions that some neighbors found him at a train crossing inside his idling car, asleep. The time when he cracked 3 ribs in the middle of a birding class on his property in the shadow of Wallens Ridge. He'd heard the spectacular clang of a 2-car wreck in the distance and ran toward the road, only to find one of his own patients dead and the other driver flipped over, bottles of liquor and pills scattered around his car. Van Zee sounded the alarm about OxyContin, just as its makers were on the threshold of grossing its first billion on the blockbuster drug. And though he didn't know it yet, he would spend the remainder of his career dealing with its aftermath, lobbying policymakers, treating the addicted, and attending funerals of the overdose dead. But back in the early days of OxyContin, Van Zee was as puzzled as he was concerned. He told Sue Cantrell about a new condition he'd spotted among some of his older opioid addicts, skin abscesses caused by injecting the crushed-up drug. He was beginning to think that OxyContin, especially in its 40 and 80 milligram forms, was another animal entirely from the 10 milligram Percocet pills some teenagers use recreationally on the weekends. His region had long been home to prescription drug abuse, though to a much smaller degree. Before OxyContin, Van Zee treated only 1 to 3 narcotic-dependent patients a year. But he was starting to get regular phone calls from worried parents about their young adult kids. Jobs, homes, spouses, and children were being lost to OxyContin addiction. A banker he knew had already spent $80,000 of his savings after his son used his credit cards to buy items he could trade for Oxys. Down the hall from his office, a physician colleague treated a septuagenarian farmer who had owned land worth $500,000. Within 6 months, the man had sold everything he had to keep his addiction fed. "It's over," he told his doctor. "The kids are gone. The wife's gone. The farm's gone." The doctors were witnessing the same thing that Lieutenant Stollard had seen a year earlier in 1997 on the streets. "We always had people using Lortabs and Percocets, but they were 5 or 10 milligram pills you could take every day and still function. They didn't have to have more," Stollard said. "The difference with OxyContin was it turned them into non-functioning people." Convinced about the looming crisis, Cantrell, the region's top public health official, called the public health commissioner in Richmond in the late 1990s. "I said, look, we've had substance abuse problems for years," she said. "But this was a new kind of chemical, much more potent than anything we'd seen from the small subset of addicts we'd had since the 70s or 80s. She was told it was a problem for the Department of Behavioral Health and Substance Abuse Health Services, even though the infections put people at risk of tuberculosis and the shared needles and snorting straws could hasten the spread of hepatitis C and HIV, the buck was passed. Officially, this was not a public health matter." "Nobody would listen to her," said Dr. Molly Odell, then a fellow health department director several counties to the east. "But she was right there in the epicenter of where the pill started. She's the first person I ever heard to name it. She called me and said, 'Molly, I think we got an epidemic down here.'" In 1997, the Roanoke-based medical examiner counted one OxyContin death in Southwest Virginia, The next year, 3, and the year after that, 16. But those numbers were inexplicably unexposed until 2001, 5 years after Purdue launched its drug. A Drug Enforcement Administration official told a Richmond reporter that illicit opioids were unlikely to spread beyond the mountains to the state capital, declaring Southwest Virginia a little bit unique, although he conceded there were other oxy-abuse hotspots in rural Maine, Cincinnati, Baltimore, and Charleston, West Virginia. Contacted by the same Richmond reporter, a spokesman for Purdue Pharma declined to discuss the illicit use of the company's drug. So it happened that in the early 2000s, Debbie Honecker, a happily married 27-year-old mother from the town of Lebanon, 2 counties to the east of Van Zee, recovered from a fairly routine gallbladder surgery with a 30-day prescription of Oxy-10s, followed by another script at her post-surgery checkup for another month's supply, this time for Oxy-40s. When she called to complain that her incision was still hurting, the surgeon gave her a third prescription for 7.5 milligram Percocet designed to quell her breakthrough pain, with instructions to take it not as needed for pain, but as frequently as every 2 hours, concurrent with the 12-hour oxys. To remind her to take the Percocet, she was supposed to set an alarm for the middle of the night. "The doctor didn't force me to take them," Honecker said, "but they're like a high-standard person, someone you're supposed to trust and believe in. My husband and I both understood that I was supposed to take the pill every 2 hours." They have discussed that defining moment a lot in the intervening years. They've wondered aloud what might have happened had her gallbladder not given out at the same time the factories and mines were laying off and shutting down. She might not have visited a neighbor, a well-known pill abuser, for advice on what to do when the pain wouldn't subside. "If you snort them up your nose, they hit you better," her neighbor told her. She might not have found herself doubled over and dope sick the day her prescriptions ran out. "You're throwing up, you have diarrhea, you ache so bad and you're so irritable that you can't stand to be touched. Your legs shake so bad you can't sleep. You're as ill as one hornet could ever be," she recalled. "And believe me, you'll do anything to make that pain go away." She might not have later turned in the throes of withdrawal to her 60-year-old neighbor, Margie, one of the growing legions of laid-off workers in town, or suggested that, given Margie's bad hip from decades of standing on hard factory floors, she should go visit the town's so-called pain doctor and ask him to write you, parlance for coaxing a prescription out of a doctor, by making the pain seem more debilitating than it really is. She might not have driven Margie to the appointment, then coached her on what to say. "She didn't want to do it," Honecker recalled. "Margie would say, 'God knows I wouldn't be doing this if I didn't have to choose between paying a bill or going to the doctor to get the medicines I really need for diabetes and high blood pressure.'" Within the span of 3 months, Honecker had mastered the classic drug-seeking emergency room trick, beginning with an impassioned complaint about kidney stone pain. "I'd say, 'My back's killing me,' and in the ER bathroom, I'd pierce my finger, then put a drop of blood into my urine sample," she recalled. She'd leave with a prescription for Percocet. She was a full-blown opioid addict when she resorted to stealing the money her husband set aside for paying the electric bill and spending it at the office of a well-known Lebanon doctor who began most of her visits to him with the question, "What do you want?" The Board of Medicine suspended Dr. Dwight Bailey's license to practice medicine in 2014 for excessive prescribing and poor record keeping, noting that 5 patients had died from drug overdoses while under his care. But that was more than a decade after Honecker first came through his doors. Honecker went on to steal painkillers from her husband's elderly grandmother. She bought pills from people who paid $1 for their OxyContin prescriptions using their Medicaid cards. "They've got to choose to eat or pay their electric bill, but if they're on Medicaid, they can sell their drugs to supplement their income," she said. In an Appalachian culture that prides itself on self-reliance and a feisty dose of fatalism, peddling pills was now the modern-day moonshining. Some passed the trade secrets down to their kids because, after all, how else could they afford to eat and pay their bills? "It's our culture now, taking pills," said Crystal Street, whose father, an octogenarian, got hooked on morphine and Dilaudid in the wake of a coal mining injury. By 2016, he was on house arrest for selling prescription pills from his nursing home bed. "I come from a long line of distributors," Street told me. We spoke at an addiction clinic in Lebanon, where she and Honecker were being treated with a medication-assisted treatment, MAT, drug called Suboxone. Like its methadone predecessor, Suboxone staves off dope sickness, reduces cravings, and, if prescribed appropriately and used correctly, does not get you high. Both middle-aged Street and Honecker had each been jailed. They took turns telling twin near-death stories, one beginning where the other left off. They'd both lost their teeth. "You get sick and throw up, or you live pills in your mouth and it takes the enamel off," Honecker said. Neither had ever had steady work. "You couldn't keep a job because you'd steal if you worked at a restaurant," Street added. "Or you just couldn't get up and go. You were too sick." Honecker put in, "At the end of your journey, you're not going after drugs to get high. You're going to keep from being sick." Art Van Zee saw it unfolding, and he was terrified. Within 2 years of the drug's release, 24% of Lee High School juniors reported trying OxyContin, and so had 9% of the county's 7th graders. And Van Zee not only met with worried parents, he'd been called out to the hospital late at night about the overdose of a teenage girl he'd immunized as a baby. He remembered the exact position at the St. Charles Clinic where he'd first held her. He was standing by the counter made of materials recycled from a long-gone coal company's commissary where coal miners once gathered to collect their pay in scrip. The miners had portions of their pay deducted from their salary to build the clinic in 1973. They'd also organized bake sales and talent shows and spent years soliciting donations, many of the efforts shepherded by a trio of plucky nuns who'd migrated to the region a decade earlier, heeding LBJ's and Robert Kennedy's call to help Appalachia fight the war on poverty. Nicknamed the Nickel and Dime Clinic, it was literally built by coal miners and community activists, people who chipped in every penny of their spare change. These weren't simply Van Zee's patients who were showing up in the ER. They were dear friends, many of them descendants of the coal miners whose pictures lined his exam room walls. They hailed from nearby coal camps with names like Monarch, Virginia Lee, and Bonnie Blue. When patients recognized a relative in the old black and white photos, Van Zee took the time to write their names down on the back of the pictures. In the spring of 2000, small-town newspaper stories weren't yet available online, and rural news typically didn't travel far. Van Zee had no idea the force he was now wrestling with had already had a hold elsewhere until a young doctor working in the clinic went home to visit relatives in the Northeast and hand-carried a Boston Globe story back to the clinic in St. Charles. The story was headlined, "A Prescription for Crime." Machias, Maine was a remote town known for its juxtapositions of coastal beauty and blueberries, of poverty and population decline. Its parallels to Lee County were stunning. In a region of just 36,000 residents, the Washington County jail population had doubled in 2 years. It was overcrowded with young adults and middle-aged women and men, drug users and diverters who were facing charges of break-ins and robberies. A level of violent crime that was wholly unprecedented in the region had begun, including the firebombing of a police cruiser. The plain-spoken sheriff blamed the new criminal landscape on OxyContin, and the DEA agreed, noting that Purdue's drug was being prescribed more than twice as often as in other parts of the state. And though OxyContin's initial converts in Maine were fishermen and loggers, not coal miners, the results were the same. People were walking prescriptions or stealing prescription pads the moment a doctor turned his or her back. They were shopping, too, quietly soliciting concurrent prescriptions from multiple doctors. Selling prescribed pills available for a pittance with an insurance or Medicaid card was now seen as a viable way of paying your bills in a county where the unemployment rate hovered around 22%. In a place where people had once left keys in cars and didn't bother locking their homes, a 41-year-old resident told the Globe reporter he now kept a loaded gun inside the house. A quarter of his former high school classmates had developed addictions to Oxy. Van Zee's co-worker distributed copies of the Boston Globe story to others in the clinic, marveling, "That's us." Near the other end of the Appalachians, some 1,800 miles from Maine, it dawned on Van Zee and his wife that they were not alone, and they needed to get organized. Within weeks, Van Zee had put on several public meetings under the auspices of the Lee Coalition for Health, a grassroots group of ministers, social workers, and other community-minded people. Edited and coached by his lawyer wife, a plucky former Vista volunteer, he wrote letters of complaint to Purdue, noting injection patterns, frequent overdoses, abscesses, and a higher incidence of hepatitis C. "The extent and prevalence of the problem are hard to overemphasize," he wrote on August 20, 2000, in his first letter to Dr. David Haddox, then the company's medical director, beseeching him to investigate Purdue's prescribing patterns in the region. In another, he wrote, "My fear is that these are sentinel areas, just as San Francisco and New York were in the early years of HIV. The company replied by sending Van Zee and his medical partner some paperwork called Adverse Events Report Forms. At a forum for area doctors and families, Van Zee brought in Yale University substance abuse experts to describe the sudden physical and psychological stress caused by dope sickness, outlining a hard truth that many Americans still fail to grasp. Opioid addiction is a lifelong and typically relapse-filled disease. 40 to 60% of addicted opioid users can achieve remission with medication-assisted treatment, according to 2017 statistics, but sustained remission can take as long as 10 or more years. Meanwhile, about 4% of the opioid addicted die annually of overdose. When the researchers recommended that area doctors prescribe other, less abuse-prone drugs to patients with severe pain, a Purdue pharma rep who'd been sitting incognito in the crowd rose to sharply challenge him. "The problem was inadequate pain treatment," he insisted, "not OxyContin's abuse." Suella, Van Zee's wife, worried that the patient load was getting her husband down. But instead, she witnessed a burst of energy and something she'd never seen in her mild-mannered husband, righteous anger. By November, his letters took on a sharper tone, as he described patients who drove the 5-hour round trip to Knoxville, Tennessee for maintenance methadone, including a 23-year-old woman who woke at 4 a.m. and made the drive to the clinic with her 4-year-old daughter in the car. Van Zee attended a nearby meeting of the Appalachian Pain Foundation, a Purdue-funded professional association whose job was to capitalize on the growing pain management movement of the 1990s and to amplify its organizing principle, that pain remained vastly undertreated. The invitation to the meeting featured a quote from a 17th century English apothecary. "Among the remedies which it has pleased Almighty God to give man to relieve his suffering, none is so universal or efficacious as opium." Van Zee presented the company with two major requests: stop the aggressive marketing of OxyContin for the treatment of non-cancer pain, and reformulate the drug to make it less prone to abuse. As an example, he touted the makers of the painkiller Talwin, who in a 1982 reformulation had added a narcotic blocker or antagonist called naloxone to the mix and immediately reduced the drug's diversion and misuse. In the fall of 2000, a newspaper story had run in nearby Tazewell County, Virginia, about an uptick in crime. Between August 1999 and August 2000, 150 people had been charged with OxyContin-related felonies. In a county of just 44,000 people, there had been 10 armed robberies of drugstores in the past 18 months. Unemployed Tazewell miners like Doug Clark, who'd once made $35 an hour, were now in legal trouble for ripping copper from an abandoned mining equipment shop to resell on the black market and fund his next OxyContin buy. Clark had gotten hooked after surgery to repair an injured neck and broken jaw. A rock had fallen on him inside a nearby Russell County mine, since closed. Purdue's medical director Haddox called the reporter, Teresa M. Clemens, to complain about her crime coverage, and he seemed intimidating. Now, at the meeting that followed Clemens' reporting, Haddox met with Van Zee, the county prosecutor, and other county officials who told him about oxy-related property crimes and check forgeries, and addicts who were doctor shopping multiple physicians to feed their habit and to make a buck. Hypodermic needles were turning up at routine traffic stops. While Perdue was concerned about the problem in the coal fields, Haddock said, he believed the worries were overblown. At the meeting, when Haddock and his colleagues steered the conversation toward the under-prescribing of narcotics, Prosecutor Dennis Lee was gobsmacked. "We have never seen anything like this before," Lee interrupted. "There's just no comparison, not just pill counting, but the human tragedies." On the way out of the meeting, Van Zee pulled Haddock aside to reiterate his concerns about the promotional gimmicks the company was lavishing on doctors. "The physician freebies needed to stop," Van Zee said. "How is that any different from what every other drug company does?" Haddock fired back. "People aren't stealing from their families or breaking into their neighbors' homes over blood pressure pills," Van Zee said. Van Zee didn't yet grasp what was truly driving the furious rate of overprescription. Sales rep bonuses were growing exponentially, from $1 million in 1996, the year OxyContin hit the market, to $40 million in 2001. New patients were given OxyContin starter coupons for free prescriptions, redeemable for a 30-day supply, and Perdue conducted more than 40 national pain management and speaker training conferences, luring doctors to resorts from Boca Raton, Florida, to Scottsdale, Arizona. The trips were free, including beach hats with the royal blue OxyContin logo. More than 5,000 doctors, nurses, and pharmacists attended the conferences during the drug's first 5 years, all expenses paid. "The doctors started prostituting themselves for a few free trips to Florida," recalled lawyer Emmett Yeary from nearby Abingdon, Virginia. As Van Zee delivered his message in meetings and letters, some desperate families hired Yeary to represent their loved ones for oxy-related crimes. "The irony of it was, the victims were getting jail time instead of the people who caused it," Yeary recalled. He remembered a dislocated coal miner from Grundy, Virginia, confessing that OxyContin had become more important to him than his family, his church, and his children. "It became my God," the man said. By the end of 2000, Perdue had passed out 15,000 copies of an OxyContin video called "I Got My Life Back, Patients in Pain Tell Their Story," without submitting it to the FDA for review as required by the agency. The video, available for checkout from doctors' offices, lauded OxyContin's effect on patients' quality of life and minimized its risks. The doctor narrator heralded the new term pseudo-addiction, wherein opioid-seeking patients look like a drug addict because they're pursuing pain relief, when in reality it's relief-seeking behavior mistaken as drug addiction. He then repeated Haddock's favorite soundbite, that opioid analgesics caused addiction in less than 1% of patients. The source of this claim was a one-paragraph letter to the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine written in 1980. The letter was never intended as a conclusion on the risks of long-term opiate use, one of the authors would much later explain, yet it was trotted out repeatedly during OxyContin's first decade. At dine-and-dash gatherings and in doctor's office from the coal fields to the California coast, this letter about an unrelated initiative was repeated and tweaked until its contents no longer resembled anything close to the author's intention, like an old-fashioned game of telephone gone terribly awry. A year after starring in the Perdue Pharma video, that same doctor, South Carolina pain specialist Dr. Alan Spanos, gave a lecture insisting that patients with chronic non-cancer pain should be trusted to decide for themselves how many painkillers they could take without overdosing, just as the morphine-dispensing doctors had said of wounded Civil War veterans a century before. He reasoned that the patients would simply go to sleep before they stopped breathing. By March 2001, Van Zee was as fed up with letter writing as the alarmed Richmond doctor had been in 1884. Precisely 2 decades before his peers took up the cause, and 3 decades before the government began regulating the drugs. "I have heard them, with tears in their eyes, say that they had wished it had never been prescribed for them." Van Zee's neighbors were dying. The region had now buried 43 people, dead of oxycodone overdose since Perdue launched its drug. Addicted users had gone from snorting to routinely injecting the liquefied crushed-up powder with livestock syringes they bought or stole from local feed stores. At the Lee County Jail, 79 people were crammed into cells designed to hold 34. We were so overwhelmed we were just stacking them on the floor, the sheriff, Gary Parsons, told me. One of the prisoners had bought 4 OxyContin tablets by trading away his family's mule. While attempting to make a night deposit at the bank next door, the manager of Payless Supermarket in nearby Coburn was gunned down by a masked robber trying to fund his next OxyFix. A half hour away in Clintwood, a man made the bold move of throwing a cement block through the front door of a pharmacy, even though it was across the street from the courthouse and the sheriff's department. A deputy heard the alarm go off, and here's this guy running away and dropping pill bottles along the way. He's so high. Richard Stollard, the lieutenant, recalled. In small towns where residents were used to leaving their doors unlocked, patrol officers were suddenly seeing people pushing stolen lawnmowers, four-wheelers, and even garden tillers down the street. "We called it spot and steal," recalled Reverend Clyde Hester, who joined Van Zee and Sue Ella in their Lee Coalition for Health, the grassroots group. "They look for things during the day. Weed eaters were popular, and then at night they come back and pick them up," he said. To fuel his OxyContin habit, Hester's own son stole his gun, which the minister later retrieved from a local pawn shop. A man in Dryden killed a young man attempting to break into his house to steal his wife's prescription drugs, which he'd spotted above the kitchen sink windowsill down the road from Van Zee's house. And as metal prices rose, Sheriff Parsons reported thieves stealing everything from copper cemetery bases to wires plucked from a telephone pole that addicted users had chopped down. Parsons even had his stepson arrested for stealing his own personal checks to buy black market OxyContin. "There is literally not a family in this county that has not been impacted by this drug," he told me in 2017, a statement I heard in every Appalachian county I visited. In early 2001, Van Zee and the Lee County Coalition for Health launched a petition drive asking the FDA to order a recall of the potent painkiller via a website called RecallOxyContinNow.org. Drawing deeper lines in the sand between Van Zee and the industry, and also between him and most of his physician peers, the petition received more than 10,000 signatures, most from Lee County, and the result of a standing-room-only town hall forum he organized at the high school in March 2001. In a place where people barely have money for gas in their cars, by far this was the largest crowd I'd ever seen gathered in Lee County, one organizer told me. 800 people attended, some sitting in the auditorium aisles. Roanoke-based U.S. Attorney Bob Crouch called OxyContin the crack of Southwest Virginia, with oxy overdose deaths now substantially surpassing those caused by cocaine and heroin. The next month, the DEA developed a national action plan to monitor Purdue, asking the company to limit distribution of the drug, rethink its marketing strategy, and consider reformulating the drug to be abuse-resistant. This marked the first time in the agency's history that it targeted a specific drug to be policed by its manufacturer to prevent diversion and abuse. In response, the company announced a 10-point plan to curb abuse, including the distribution of tamper-resistant prescription pads, an educational program aimed at alerting teens to the dangers of prescription drugs, and a $100,000 grant for the creation of a statewide prescription monitoring program, or PMP, to halt doctor shopping. The company also stopped distributing its most potent form of OxyContin, the 160-milligram pill, and reduced shipments to Mexico in light of reports that the drug was being smuggled back into the United States, sometimes by people making the 23-hour drive from Virginia's coal fields to the Mexican border or flying with pills taped to their back. With great fanfare in July 2001, the FDA announced it had worked with Purdue to put a black box warning on the drug, the strongest type of prescription drug caution. The goal was to help prevent inappropriate prescriptions, misuse, and diversion. But a company spokesman downplayed the black box, calling it more of an exercise in graphic design, and pointing out that legitimate users didn't experience the high created by abusers who snorted or injected the drug. The real victims, executives said time and again, were the legitimate patients who would be denied OxyContin if its distribution were restricted. That year, a former Purdue rep remembered, the salesperson attended one of the company's new seminars on diversion and abuse, meant to educate reps so they could inform authorities about suspected diversion. It was now possible for a rep who called on indiscriminate prescribers to earn as much as $100,000 a quarter in bonus pay alone, the rep told me. It behooved them to have the pill mills writing high doses, the rep added. The diversion abuse seminar was just a cover-their-ass type of thing. Let's be clear, a Purdue Pharma spokesperson said in August 2001 in a meeting with Virginia's attorney general. The issue is drug abuse, not the drug. The product shouldn't be blamed for deaths because in many cases, the victims were also drinking alcohol and taking other drugs. Van Zee scoffed, telling a Roanoke Times reporter, "To me, that's like somebody who was shot with a howitzer and a BB gun, and you walk up and say it's a little hard to tell what killed him. Was it the howitzer that took off half his chest, or was it the BB gun?" Another set of scales fell from the doctor's eyes as a distinct possibility flashed before him. No one in federal government would take seriously the concerns of a country doctor until opioid abuse took hold in the cities and suburbs. "If it's a bunch of poor folks up in the mountains, it doesn't affect them personally," he said. Purdue had tried in vain to quiet the Appalachian naysayers a few months before, in March 2001, by offering Stallard and other county leaders a $100,000 grant they could put toward drug treatment and law enforcement. The offer had come the day after a meeting Van Zee arranged between Purdue executives and concerned family members, including a prominent Pennington Gap banker, the one whose addicted son had already blown through $80,000 of his life savings. If Purdue wouldn't listen to local doctors and cops, Van Zee reasoned, maybe it would listen to someone whose son's addiction had nearly depleted his 401k. "We are an average family," the banker said in his appeal to the executives, showing them a picture of his son. The banker had grown up in the Monarch coal camp, putting himself through college one night school class at a time. Before his son stole from the family to buy black market OxyContin, he had been a good student and a burly outdoorsman. "Surely you have got enough patriotism to worry about this country," the banker said. He pointed out that the company must have known Lee County, population 23,000, had an OxyContin problem before Lee County did, considering that it was sending as many pills to the region as it was to areas five times the size. "I'm sorry your family is having such a problem," Purdue's chief executive officer, Michael Friedman, said. At the meeting's end, the executive stunned the group when they laid out an ad they planned to place in the local newspaper, a full-page open letter to the people of Lee County. In it, the company contended that Purdue had not targeted its marketing to areas like Appalachia with high disability or Medicaid rates, nor had the company known of the drug's abuse potential. Purdue Pharma also disputed suggestions that it could quickly or easily reformulate the drug. The parent meeting had been a setup. Whereas Van Zee thought the company might finally be willing to make some compromises, Art really thought Purdue would feel some empathy toward the banker, Suella recalled. It was plain now that was not the case. The meeting had been brokered to shove the ad down the group's throat. Suella blew up, telling Haddox, "You have done more to hurt Appalachia than the coal industry has ever thought about doing." Haddox said he resented the implication, and Suella said she didn't give a damn if he did. "I said, look, I'm an Appalachian scholar, and my family goes back here forever, and I take tremendous insult," she recalled. She stormed out with the others, and the newspaper ad never ran. The next day, Friedman gathered with Richard Stallard and other law enforcement officers at Kathy's Country Kitchen in the Lee County seat. Sister Beth Davies, the pluckiest of the three nuns who had answered the War on Poverty call, was in attendance. So was pharmacist Greg Stewart, a minor son whose parents had personally helped build the St. Charles Clinic. When Stewart filled OxyContin prescriptions, he begged his customers to lock their medications up. He'd already been the victim of two robbery attempts, including one by the son of a neighboring hair salon owner who crawled in through the ceiling vents connecting the salon to Stewart's store. When Purdue Pharma offered to put $100,000 toward expanding the county's drug treatment and law enforcement efforts, Stewart said he was inclined to accept the donation as partial payback, considering the fortune the company was making off the area's misery. Van Zee and Suella agreed and even drafted a letter of acceptance after the meeting. Suella explained that she was initially for accepting the money because of my experience with the coal companies taking and taking and taking, and all the companies they sit up north with their inherited wealth and leave nothing behind except broken bodies. But Sister Beth, the 5-foot-tall red-headed nun, was having none of it. The executives might be able to intimidate the people up north, where their philanthropy held sway in places like Harvard and Manhattan, But Beth was a formidable New Yorker herself with a master's from Columbia. More important, she'd grown up under the tutelage of high-powered nuns who ran hospitals and colleges with a firm hand but a fair eye and a mother who read a book every day. A Staten Island native, Sister Beth had worked in Stamford, Connecticut, Purdue's hometown, where she ran a Catholic school before moving to Appalachia in 1971. A former student of hers from Connecticut had recently called to apologize, in fact. He was a reporter at the Stamford newspaper, which had been strongly encouraged not to write anything critical of the company, she said. In 1996, the same year OxyContin was introduced, Sister Beth had stood up to a crowd of 60 coal miners and executives and their lawyers, all men, to demand the Lone Mountain Coal Company make reparations for the havoc caused by one of its faulty coal slurry ponds. A liner had burst, sending wastewater screaming through the village of St. Charles. The water unloosed a boulder that rammed a resident's house, flooded other homes, scattered coal waste and litter for miles along the Powell River, endangering fish and mussel beds, and generally scared people half to death. That event pitted company miners from other camps, forced to defend the company or lose their pay for the day, against local miners whose community had been devastated by the flood. Lone Mountain's defense, as articulated by one of the outside miners, the town was already full of litter and pampered trees. Therefore, the flooding was simply another act of nature, unleashed on an already diaper-scarred landscape. Healthcare Administrator Tony Lawson remembered the way Sister Beth stood up in that meeting. This tiny little thin woman who was so angry the paper she was holding with her statement shook in her hands, but she spoke loud and clear to all those men in that audience. She was absolutely the most fearless, bravest person I've ever seen. The executives glared and the hired miners booed, but Sister Beth didn't waver. Though the coal company eventually paid to clean up the mess, not nearly enough in the nuns' opinion, the flood of slurry pond waste was an ominous harbinger for St. Charles. If the Purdue executives thought that people like Sue Ella and Sister Beth could be bought, they had not done their homework. Both had stood on the picket lines with strikers and their families for 9 life and death months in 1989, when the Pittston Coal Company wanted such huge union contract concessions as reduced pay-in to retired miners' health insurance and wage cuts. Sister Beth had literally lain on the ground to block the coal trucks, while Sue Ella stood next to the striking miners with her 6-month-old baby in a carrier. Over the years, Sue Ella's and Sister Beth's lives had been threatened because of their social activism, including once when Beth convinced an illiterate coal miner not to sign away all company liability for mining accident. "Greed makes people violent," she told an interviewer in 1982. "When we stand with the least in the struggle for justice, there's a price to pay." The Purdue offer was just another page in an old story. "This is what happens when wealthy people think they own you," Sister Beth told her Lee County friends. Since the first piece of coal was chiseled from the first mountainside rock by a large out-of-state corporation, the region had suffered from a pattern of exploitation, she said, ticking off all the mining company executives who'd flown in over the years and spread their money around trying to buy peace and then shut down unions, reduce black lung benefits, and kept other industries out to maintain low labor costs. Sister Beth thought about all the firsts she was starting to see at her addiction education center in Pennington Gap, where she and Van Zee were now conferring daily over their mutual patients, among them young women now prostituting themselves for drug money. She thought about the high school senior, a cheerleader, snorting OxyContin in the school library, about the people having their teeth pulled for the sole purpose of eliciting an Oxy prescription from a dentist, about the middle-aged woman who'd ruefully remarked in the middle of being fingerprinted and photographed that she was wearing the same gray sweatpants she'd had on the last time she was arrested for distributing OxyContin. "I'd burn those if I were you," a sheriff's deputy quipped. But it wasn't funny to Sister Beth. She recalled the first phone call she'd taken about the drug in the late 90s. The informant had told the cop called the pharmacist called Sister Beth. It was another game of telephone, only this message remained tragically on point. "Beth, you wait," pharmacist Stewart had told her on the phone. "They're saying it's non-addictive, but you mark my words. This is the beginning of a disaster for us." The disaster was now in full bloom, and Sue Ella and Sister Beth guessed exactly where it was headed. Even if Big Pharma and the pill mill doctors could be brought to justice, the morphine molecule was so deadly, its lure so intractable, that those who were already addicted were likely to be ruled by it for the rest of their lives. Sister Beth threatened to quit the coalition if anyone accepted Purdue Pharma's $100,000 grant, and Van Zee's letter of acceptance was never sent. The grant was nothing more than blood money, she said, and the coalition agreed. Chapter 3. Message Board Memorial. While regional reporters from Boston and Roanoke were unpacking the damage done in the rural outposts, the story of the burgeoning OxyContin epidemic didn't hit the national media until February 9, 2001, when New York Times reporter Barry Meyer and a colleague swooped in just north of Lee County for a front-page story on Operation OxyFest, a 9-month federal investigation that had produced the biggest drug abuse raid in Kentucky history. "We caught 207 user dealers," a federal prosecutor told Meyer. Most of those arrested were patients who had coaxed pills out of doctors who were either busy, slipshod, or quietly cooperative in overprescribing the drug. "We didn't catch half of them. That's how pervasive this thing is." That summer, it became clear that OxyContin abuse had seeped out of the western Virginia and Maine backwoods, creeping up and down the Appalachian Range. The news was disseminating, finally, not just to big cities on the East Coast, but also into the Deep South and parts of the Southwest. Overdose deaths and OxyContin-fueled crime grabbed headlines from Miami-Dade County to Bridgeport, Connecticut. Across the country, OxyContin was becoming a staple of suburban teenage farm parties, or farming as the practice of passing random pills around in hats was known, ironically in farming communities. It would fall, ultimately, to the parents of the dead to organize the first national response, specifically to a 39-year-old IT worker named Ed Bish. In February 2001, Bish had been summoned home to his working-class enclave of Philadelphia after taking a frantic call from his daughter, who'd just found her 18-year-old brother passed out and turning blue in the bathroom. Bish arrived home to find a pair of emergency workers sitting on his front lawn. His son Eddie was a high school senior, a soccer player with decent grades, and plans to attend a local culinary school. Eddie had complained of feeling ill recently, but it had not crossed his father's mind that he was deep into opioid withdrawal. Bish had suspected Eddie was drinking and maybe smoking pot, but hadn't considered pills. They had plans to fly to Florida for a father-son fishing vacation in just 6 days. "I'm sorry," one of the paramedics told Bish. Eddie was dead. As friends gathered, Bish was still in shock and grappling for answers when he asked the first responders what his son had taken. "Oxy," one said. "What the hell's an oxy?" Bish wanted to know. The first time Ed Bish heard the word OxyContin, his son was dead from it. If parents were slow to catch on to the epidemic, experts weren't any quicker. The movement of OxyContin from the economically straitened hinterlands to the largely more affluent cities and suburbs in the early aughts reminded historian David Courtwright of the iatrogenic wave of opium and morphine addiction that stormed the nation exactly a century before. By the 1920s and 30s, most of the small-town morphine addicts and Civil War veterans with soldiers' disease had died out, not long after the national crackdown hastened by the Harrison Narcotics Act, which set the scene for drug prohibition and later the so-called war on drugs. After the old-time addicts died out, narcotics were unheard of throughout the mid-20th century unless you got cancer, Courtwright said. For most of the previous century, opioid addiction was mainly relegated to big northeastern cities, where heroin had long been smuggled in through illicit channels, infiltrating the Harlem jazz scene of the 1940s and the beatnik subculture of the 1950s. The term hipster, in fact, drew from the Chinese opium smoker of the 1800s who'd spent much of his time smoking while reclining on one hip. The hipster counterculture took inspiration from heroin-addicted jazz greats like Charlie Parker and John Coltrane. But where prescribed painkillers were concerned, the Harrison Act had effectively contained the earlier iatrogenic wave of addiction, and the small-town female morphine addict gave way to the image of the hustling, mainlining male junkie. Progressive doctors championed the carefully restricted use of narcotics and called out heavy prescribers for being behind the times. Pharmacists, too, upped the refill bar so high that in 1955, the heroin-addicted beat writer and artist William Burroughs called them sour, puritanical shits, unlikely to fill even a codeine prescription without checking with the doctor's office first. When 20% of American soldiers came back from Vietnam with symptoms of heroin dependence, researchers were initially puzzled by the fact that most didn't go on to become heroin addicts, possibly, some theorized, because they returned to spread out social networks in rural areas and small towns where heroin didn't exist. It may have helped, too, that many were detoxed in Vietnam before they came home, with the veterans who continued to struggle with addiction typically being the ones who already had drug problems before serving. In the early 1990s, probably 90% of the heroin market was still in cities like New York, Chicago, and Detroit, Courtright explained. There was this long-standing urban hierarchy of heroin that completely dominated the illicit opioid market in the United States. But when doctors started widely prescribing OxyContin for non-cancer pain in the late 1990s, it effectively nationalized the supply, making opioids no longer a big city story. So that any doctor in any small town, under the dispensation of a new FDA-approved prescription, could now suddenly provide opioids to people with low back issues and so on. You read a lot about economic depression and loss of morale, and I'm certain that fuels the epidemic, he said. But the supply expansion via OxyContin came before anything else, and if it hadn't been for the supply expansion, then this epidemic would not have happened, Courtright said. If history was any indication, the moment OxyContin and other opioid pills became too expensive or too cumbersome to get, illegal drug peddlers would step in to fulfill the market demand, just as they had done a century earlier when heroin became illegal. For centuries, dealers of opium, morphine, and heroin understood that an addicted person's fear of running out, of becoming dope sick, pretended one hell of a business model. The author of several books on the history of drug addiction, Courtright said he used to tell his students that what most surprised me in my lifetime were things like the internet or seeing tattoos on respectable women. But I've got to add this to the list of real shockers. I'm 64 years old, and I have to admit, I didn't think I would ever see another massive wave of iatrogenic opiate addiction in my lifetime. Courtright wasn't the only one. Though it took nearly a decade before police, the press, and drug abuse experts fully understood what was happening, Ed Bish watched the urbanization of the pill epidemic play out on his front lawn in 2001 as paramedics carried his son's body away. He retreated to his computer, where he was shocked to learn that his son's death had been the region's 30th opioid overdose in the past 3 months. How was that possible when he'd only just learned the word? The internet was still new, and back then it was mostly message boards as opposed to websites, he said. Bish channeled his grief into computer code. Hoping to warn other families, he created his own message board, giving it the bluntest moniker he could think of, OxyKills.com. Within weeks, it had morphed into a scrolling database of grief, warnings, and statistics. The website became a clearinghouse for the latest Oxy-related overdose numbers reported by local medical examiners and the DEA. Bish promoted news stories about OxyContin, such as when the New York Times noted that the drug's sales in 2001 hit $1 billion, outselling even Viagra. Parents from Florida to California joined Bish in memorializing their dead children on his site, which became a running tally of dead athletes and young mothers and former beauty queens, many no more than 20 years old. I was answering every email, and it was consuming me, Bish recalled, probably 10 deaths a day. Sometimes 100 emails a week. Lee Nuss of Palm Coast, Florida, was too grief-stricken to reach out to Bish initially, but her daughter Monique called him one night, begging him to talk to her mom. Turned out they had grown up in the same section of Philly, in the same working-class neighborhood of Fishtown, less than a mile apart. And the similarities didn't end there. Nuss, too, had lost an 18-year-old son, Randy, who died of a single crushed-up 80-milligram oxy, bought from a friend whose mother wanted him to sell it to pay their rent. I had no idea he was using pills until this happened, Nuss said. She told herself that Randy hadn't been using long because she still had opioid pills prescribed to her in the wake of dental surgery that were untouched at the time of his death. The Fishtowners made an informal alliance with Banzi and Sister Beth after reading Barry Meyer's 2003 book, Painkiller. If OxyContin nationalized the opioid supply chain, Nuss and Bish nationalize the opposition to it, launching a grassroots nonprofit called Relatives Against Purdue Pharma, or RAP. It was Ed Bish's message board sprung to life, a non-virtual resistance party that would play out politically and in person over the next decade. Together, the parents-turned-activists would lobby for the creation of